you. Hi, everyone. My name is Kat, and I am an alcoholic. Denver, thank you so much for asking me to come and share, and just a huge thank you to the committee for putting this together. This is a new experience for me because I just want to thank everyone who's been so kind, because my father is here, and this is his first ever convention. And you guys have been amazing. And when Deborah asked me to share a couple of months ago, I remember my first reaction was like, no. Do you know what I mean? That's like, you know, my first thought. You know, I'm not good enough. I'm not going to have anything to share. And then my intuition kicks in. And I say, okay, my higher power is asking me for a reason. So when I'm asked to do service and I can do it, I say yes. I don't listen to my head. I do the opposite of what my head's telling me. And because of that, I'm getting to have this experience with my father. So I'm very grateful for that. So thank you. My sobriety date is July 1st, 2012. And this was not part of the plan. I did not want to be an alcoholic. So a little bit of my story. I actually qualify for Al-Anon and ACA, but I've practiced the steps so far in AA. And so I'll be sharing as a member of AA tonight. My mother got sober when I was 5, and I had a healthy respect for Mum's meetings. And I knew that this worked because she had been sober for a long time. But I did not think that I was an alcoholic. And she was an incredible woman. She watched as my alcoholism progressed. And she knew that she was powerless over it, just like she'd been powerless over her own alcoholism. And, you know, in her AA wisdom, what she did was she planted little seeds. At no point did she tell me, you're an alcoholic. She didn't say to me, you've got to come to a meeting with me. But she planted little seeds. And I was a big whiskey drinker. I loved whiskey. But it sent me crazy. And I remember I would have been about 17 or 18. And I sat down with her and I said, you know, it's all right, Mom. I'm controlling it. I've switched whiskey to vodka. And I was like, you know, vodka's keeping me straight. And I said, I've got this under control. And she smiled. And she said, the thing is, Trina, that once you try to control something, you've already lost control. And I thought, wait, she's got a point there. But I wasn't ready to hear it yet. You know, and my alcoholism, you know, it progressed, and you know, the consequences got bigger, and I became number, you know, and that's, you know, especially those last years of drinking, you know, I would do the same thing over and over again, but I was no longer expecting a different result. You know, I knew what the result was going to be. It was going to be that I was probably going to black out, probably offend or hurt somebody. And then I was going to feel the shame and the guilt the next morning. And she understood that. We moved around the world. I was actually born in Munich. And everywhere that we moved, like, her big book was always present. It was always, like, in the living rooms of all the different houses we lived in. And she watched, you know, as it got progressively worse. And I would say things to her like, you know, it was that 7th vodka and tonic that got me into trouble. And she would say, Trina, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I'd kind of sit there and I'm like, okay. And all these things, obviously, you know, once I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I was ready to hear. But up until that point, you know, it was my mother that was trying to carry the message to me. And like I said, she planted those little seeds. And, you know, I was in this conflicted position. I was powerless. I was doing things that I didn't want to do. And I didn't know how to stop it. And there were mornings where, you know, I was back living at home. You know, the relationship had ended. I was in love with, you know, an amazing man. And he was quite straight-laced. And I think, you know, looking back on it now, like, I chose him for that. Because I thought, you know, I'm going to drink the way that I want, and he's going to take care of me. And that's what he did for a number of years. And he had the courage to leave that relationship. And when he did that, it kind of took away that safety net that I'd had. And it was like all bets were off. And each time I drank to get drunk. This is a progressive illness. You know, it started out, you know, like everyone was doing it when I was younger. And it was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun during my drinking. But by the time I was 19, 20, and then subsequently 25 when that relationship ended, I could not get back to those fun times. And, you know, my mother would say to me, Trina, it's like Russian roulette. You know, each time I would go out, I wouldn't know what was really going to happen. And I guess for me, that's part of the definition of powerlessness. And I made, you know, like it talks about in our big book, I made these kind of solemn oaths, you know, to swear off the stuff. And, you know, sometimes I'd be able to make it a week or two, and then that trivial, you know, reason would, you know, win out. You know, it was someone's birthday, or I had, you know, leaving drinks at work. And I would say to myself, you know, I'll just have the one. And I didn't know about the physical allergy fully until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like my mom had said to me, you know, it's the first drink that does the damage, Trina. But I had to go through that experience, you know. And her experience at that time wasn't enough to get me sober. And I think she, deep down, she knew that. So she had to let me do what I needed to do. And I look back on that and I think, God, how did she do that? Right at the end of my drinking, I look back on it now, and it's divine intervention. But I went out drinking, and I remember waking up the next day, and I was like in the fetal position, and you know the guy was gone, like the job was about to go, and I woke up, and I remember I was like rocking back and forth, and I asked something to make me a better person. Because I didn't know why I kept doing what I was doing. And today I know that that was like a prayer to the universe. And there was a chain of events that led me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was living back with my mom and I was still drinking, and she had taken me in, there was this one evening, her health wasn't very well, but she had a tea commitment at a meeting called the Gospel Oak Promises Meeting. And she wasn't feeling very well, but she took her AA service commitments very seriously. And so she said to me, Trina, will you come with me and carry the tea and the coffee and the cookies to this meeting? And we'll just set it up, and I'll ask someone else to do the tea and coffee that night, but I want to bring the stuff there so they have it. And, you know, I had been treating her so badly, so the guilt of it. And so I kind of went, okay, like, yeah, I'll come. And I remember walking down there with her, and we got to the meeting. And this was about a year before I got sober. And I remember walking up those stairs, and it was like going into the lion's den. I was like, God. And I couldn't look anyone in the eye. And everyone was really lovely, and they said hello to me, and I was just there. And we put the tea and the cookies and everything out. And then we left. I walked her home. And everything happens for a reason. Because about a year later, to cut a long story short, I got arrested and fired all in the same weekend. So as well as being an alcoholic, I'm also a workaholic. And I had this idea that, you know, as long as I've got these big jobs, right, I'm okay. I'd sat in disciplinary hearings, my face all kind of bashed up because I fell over on a work night out. And it got to a point that, like, I could not hide my alcoholism. I couldn't dust myself off and go back into the office. you know, after a crazy weekend. And I sat in this disciplinary hearing, and I had my resignation letter crumpled up in my back pocket. And they, you know, they sat me down, and they read the dates and times that I had come into work hungover, or my behavior had been erratic, or I hadn't showed up. And the other thing that they said to me, which I think is very characteristic, certainly of me, this alcoholic, is they said, when you're good, but when you're bad, you're bad. And they just, they couldn't figure out what was going on with me. And I thought to myself, okay, it was like an A4 piece of paper. And I thought, okay, once they get to the bottom of it, I'm going to get my resignation letter out and I'm out of here. I don't have to deal with this. And they got to the bottom of it and I kind of got ready. And then they turned it over and it was printed double-sided. And they continued to read. I remember slinking back in my seat. And I took out the resignation letter. They accepted it very quickly. There had been points in that position where, you know, they said, you know, how can we help you? And, you know, they asked me again in that disciplinary hearing, how can we help you? And I sat there with my little beaten up face from the work night out, because I'd fallen over in front of everybody, got taken home, well, no, I got taken to a hospital and then home. And I said to them, I'm fine. You know, that was it. That was my response. I'm fine. And so got the resignation letter out, and they accepted it very quickly. And then I did what I'd always done. I let my face heal. I dusted myself off, and I got another job, you know, another very good job. And again, you know, when I'm good, I'm good. And then when I'm bad, I'm bad. And I walked into this new job, and I was about 2 weeks into it. And this is where the divine intervention takes place. I was the actual client, and I met an old work colleague of mine, an old creative director, and I had a meeting at the agency as the client. And then afterwards, he said, why don't we go downstairs and have a couple of drinks and catch up? And it was about, I don't know, it was about 3 p.m., 2 p.m. in the afternoon. And so I went downstairs to this bar in London, the T Building, and we started drinking, and I had that first drink. Right, I had no intention of, you know, what was about to follow. And I had that first drink, and then I had another, and another, and another. This particular venue, and I don't know if my dad knows this part of the story. No, it's good. I have a wonderful brother called Rory. And my brother had actually just accepted a job at this venue as the general manager. So I'm there drinking in the bar that my brother has just started to manage below this ad agency. And at some point in the evening, security were trying to throw me out. I came out of the bathroom, my jeans, you know, I was a complete mess. I didn't have a purse, that was gone. And this bouncer was trying to throw me out. And I just remember my brother, Rory, stepping in and saying, this is my sister, I'll handle this. And I was like, I was thinking, good, you're here, I can get another drink. And he said, no. He said, I'm putting you in a cab, all right, you're going home. And he gave me about 80 pounds in cash. I don't know why so much, but he gave me that, and he gave the cab driver directions to take me home. And during that cab ride, the cab driver asked if I had enough money to pay for the fare. And I said, yeah, of course I do. And I was really vile. I said, keep driving. And then at some point in that journey, I said, wait a minute. I need to get cash out so I can pay for this. And so he stopped at a cash point. And I was so drunk that I couldn't see all the 20-pound notes that were loose. And I was looking for a bank card that I no longer had. My purse was gone. And during that situation, I got into a bit of a brawl with the taxi driver. And if anybody knows Bill's story, you know, he got a job and then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. And I'm very grateful to that taxi driver because he called the police. And I ended up getting arrested. And I remember calling my mum from Holborn Police Station and saying, you've got to get me out of here. You know, these are trumped up charges. And she just said to me, "Trina, get back in that cell." That's all she would say to me. "Trina, get back in that cell." And I had no choice. My grand sponsor says, you know, that, you know, the experience of step one can be like when you're in a situation that you cannot talk your way out of. And that's where I was at. I didn't know what I'd been charged with. And when I woke up and sobered up, I had to go through the interview process. And when they released me, I remember one of the young police officers saying to me, "You have a problem with alcohol, miss." And I just thought, you know, the cheek of him to say that to me. And I came out of that cell, and they gave me back the cash. But something had changed, because there was a bar. And, you know, I just spent the weekend in a cell. Like, you know, I needed a drink. But I could not, just like Bill in the Mayflower Hotel, I could not walk into that pub. And so I went around the corner. I got a can of soda and a pack of smokes. And I sat outside the police station, just staring at this bar. But I couldn't walk in. I took myself home, and my mother was there. I went to bed. And I woke up the next afternoon, and it was a bank holiday Monday, which is like a public holiday in the UK. And I woke up, and it was about 20 to 6 in the evening. And I walked into the living room, and I said to my mom, with my hands like this, "Where do I go?" I was like, "Where do I go?" And she kind of looked at me. And she said, "You know that meeting that you helped take the tea and the coffee and the cookies to?" She was like, "It starts in 20 minutes. And she didn't offer to take me there. I didn't ask her. I took myself, my sorry self, down there. And at that meeting, there was a young girl who was greeting. You know, and she was my age. She was in her late 20s. I was 28 years old when I got sober. And I saw her, and I was kind of like hiding behind a car. And she spotted me, and she kind of ushered me over, and she took me inside. And I just remember thinking, if she's there, maybe I can be there too. Such a powerful example. And she took me inside. She got me a cup of tea. I cried my eyes out because I thought, my God, has it come to this? Alcoholics Anonymous. And the women in that meeting were amazing. They gave me their phone numbers. They got my phone number. And there was one woman at the end of the meeting who was talking at me. And I thought to myself, okay, this woman is nuts. I've got to stay away from her. And I'm really pleased to report that woman has been my sponsor for the last 12 years, a day at a time. And my mom, you know, my mom said to me, you know, when it comes to asking someone to sponsor you, my mom said, make sure you ask someone who has what you want, because that is what you're going to get. And so I watched this woman, and she was free. She was a little crazy, but she was free. And she would say things like, you know, lack of power was our dilemma. And until we read it together in the big book, like, I thought she was coming up with all these lines. And I wanted what she had. And, you know, today, you know, to get current, I still want what she has, because she wants what she has. And she works incredibly hard for it. And she's a great example, just like my mom was to me. And so I remember, you know, coming home from that meeting, I had my 24-hour chip, and I came home and I sat with my mom. And I think the next day was a working day again. And the agency called me, and the woman's voice was shaking. And I had called my new boss up in blackout and had an 8-minute conversation right before they arrested me. And And I remember going into my mom and saying, they fired me. They fired me. What am I going to do now? And my mom said, it's divine intervention, because now you can go to more meetings. And that's what I did. And that's what this alcoholic needed. I needed those things to be removed. The way that my higher power gets my attention is through pain. I don't know why it's like that, but it's the way that I am built. And the only place I had to go was meetings. And so that's what I did. I got to lots and lots of meetings. And my mom said, listen, mix your meetings up. And so I went and I did that. And in doing that, I got service. I got service at my second ever meeting, which is still my home group to this day. So it's Hampstead Hour on a Tuesday night. I went in there, and a very kind man called Mark welcomed me. And at the end of the meeting, he said, you know, we need someone to do the literature. You know, Kat, do you want to do the literature? And I remember thinking, like, I haven't read any of these books. And so I said to him, I haven't read any of these books. And he was like, it doesn't matter. He was like, I just need you to put them out pretty, like this. Will you come and do that next week? Just put them out and make them look pretty. And I thought, okay, I can do that. Going to lots of meetings meant that I was hearing the message. When I pull away from meetings, what happens is I start listening to my alcoholism. So for me, it's really important to go to meetings and hear the message so that I'm not listening to the illness. And I asked that woman, you know, to take me through the steps. And the first time I went through the steps, it was definitely a spiritual experience. I didn't quite know what I was doing, but I just followed the directions. And you know, that first step one that I did, I had never been honest with anyone like that before. And I read up, you know, the different things that I had thought and that I had done. And I remember thinking to myself, looking at that list, God, you must have really hated yourself to keep doing this over and over again. I couldn't, you know, it was like it was almost the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, the truth is that there are still many yets for me. You know, that was something that my mom drummed into me. She would say, you know, your rock bottom has a trap door. And so I have to keep that very present. And doing that step one, you know, was the only one that I had to do perfectly. And how I practice step one today is the old timers in London, they would say, get down on your knees and ask for a sober day. And I do that, not because I'm a religious person, because I'm not. I do it because it's like a physical surrender of energy, right? And I'm asking the universe for help. And I'm being honest about who I am and what I am. And so I ask for a sober, kind, and loving day. And when I do that, I have a much better day. And there have been times over the years where I've rushed out of the house and I've been like, I forgot to pray. And so I go into, you know, the bathrooms in, you know, the offices that I'm working in. And, you know, I kind of get down on my knees. And I remember the first time I did that at work, I prayed at work. I thought, this view is really familiar. And it was like, I was like, it's, you know, because I'd spent years being sick in these toilets in the morning. And there I was, like praying in them. And that was, you know, that was different. So that step one, I have to practice it every day. As was shared, this is a family illness, but our recoveries have ripple effects. With the rest of the steps, each one has a principle. And my mom, she was really big on the principles of this program. And what I know today is, I don't think she meant to do it consciously, But she had actually raised me on the principles of the, of this program. When I was younger, I remember I was being teased at school, and I would come home and I would tell her, you know, someone had called me a certain name. And my mom would say to me, "Trina, what other people think of you is none of your business." And I'd go, okay. And it gave me that, you know, that little bit of, I don't know, protection. And then years later, coming into AA, you know, I had to, you know, remember these principles. You know, step 2 and 3, I also have to practice each day. And in many ways, I end up practicing a number of steps each day. And the principles of step 2 and 3 are hope and faith. And when I went to do my step 2, I had the hope that this could work for me too, because I'd seen it work for my mom. And I saw it, you know, with the women that I was meeting in the rooms of AA. And they would share these stories with me, and I couldn't put the 2 and 2 together, because these women, they had been changed by something. You know, there's a transformation that takes place. And my mom would say to me, like, the good thing about it is that we don't always see it at first, but other people can. And I think that's a bit of a gift, because what it does is it kind of keeps the ego from resurfacing too quickly. But the other thing that my mom shared with me is, you know, the ego is the last thing to be smashed right before we get sober. And she said, but it's also the first thing to come back. And she was right about that, you know, because I remember being like, I don't know, 1.5 to 2 years sober, and I thought I knew everything. And she would just kind of smile at me. And, you know, with the, you know, the courage of step 4, you know, I'd made that decision in step 3 with my sponsor. And I remember, you know, we got down on our knees and we held hands. And I remember she had this really nice rug. And I just remember staring at the rug, and her eyes were closed. And I kind of rolled mine. I thought, this is crazy. This is never going to work. But she said to me just before I took step 3, she said, it doesn't matter what you think about this. You just have to do it. And a lot of, you know, the way that I've tried to practice this program has been just do it. Do the opposite of what your head is telling you. And that, you know, that was true when it came to writing, you know, step 4. And I had to pray through gritted teeth for the courage to continue this journey. Because when I was on my step 4, I had, you know, the ego had kind of come back. And I thought, my sponsor's crazy, all the people in the meetings are crazy, I've joined a cult, this is not good. That's what my head was telling me. There was this small, quiet voice that was just like, pray for the courage to continue this journey. And I did that. And I got through, and I just kept writing. And it was, I remember, like, today, it's my higher power, saying, all right, whatever you think about your sponsor, whatever you think about these people, like, you know the truth of how you felt and what happened. Just write it down. And that got me through that. And sharing it with another alcoholic, and she shared back with me, and that was so important. And, you know, it's a privilege to sponsor the women that I sponsor today, and to have that experience with them. And I always make sure that I share back my stuff with them. And step 6 and 7, we talk about, like stay in the middle of the bed. Step 6 and 7 are in the middle of the 12 steps. And if I am aware and practicing those 2 steps, then I'm right bang in the middle of the program. So it's a good place to be. And with step 6 and 7, I asked my higher power to take all of me, the good and the bad, because I don't know what's good for me, and I don't know what's bad for me. And so when I put myself in that position, I am kept safe and protected. And the humility, again, the beauty of it is when I'm practicing it, I'm not aware of it. other people are, but I'm not. And that's more important than anything. And with, you know, step eight, the principle is love. And I wrote that list and I answered the step eight questions. And I had tapped into a power to be willing and to be humble enough in step six and seven to make these amends in steps eight and nine. And to take responsibility for the, you know, for the first time in my life. And I was shown how to do that through the example of my mom and my sponsor and the other women that I came into contact with. And, you know, my mom would say to me, you know, when it comes to step nine, like, good guidance is required. You don't do it alone. And I stuck very close to my sponsor during that period. I made amends to my mom, and my sponsor said to me, she said, it's very difficult for one AA member to make amends to another AA member. And she was right. And so she said to me, it's not going to be easy. And I remember praying beforehand, and I approached her, and I said, you know, Mom, I'd like to make amends to you, and, you know, let me know a convenient time that we, you know, that we could do that, and if you would be up for that. And she said to me, she said, Trina, she said, you know the shit you've pulled. I know the stuff that you've done. Like, I don't want an amends. You know, I just want you to stay sober, type of thing. And she wouldn't kind of let me make it. But then she did this very clever thing. And because I said, okay, all right. She did this really clever thing, and she said, well, if you were going to make amends to me, what were you going to say? And I sat there and I thought, God, my sponsor was so right about this. And I sat there and I, you know, again, I was like, pray to stay calm. And I said, well, right? And I said, I was going to say X, Y, and Z. And I got to make that amends to her, but it was on her terms and I had to accept that. And that was incredible. And she said to me after that, she said, you know, the thing about amends, Trina, is it's not about saying sorry. She said, it's about changing the behavior. So if you amend a document, you change the document. And that really stuck with me, and it kind of prepared me, you know, for the remainder of my amends. And there were quite a few. A lot of them were professional amends, because I had done my most destructive drinking in and around the workplace, which is like the worst place to do it, right? If you don't want to get found out or lose your job. But that's where I did it. And I made amends to that ex-partner. And that actually didn't happen until I was about 5 years sober. And I went through the steps again. And at the time, my sponsor and I, we kind of agreed to disagree because I genuinely felt that I was going to cause him more harm. And so we discussed it, and again, my sponsor is also a very clever woman, and she said, well, why don't you pray to be taken to your next amends? And I said, okay, I said, I can do that, and I did. And about 3 days later, I was walking through King's Cross Station. I hadn't seen my ex in many, many years, and he walked past me. Whoa. Yeah, and he didn't see me, and it was like I was invisible, right? And he didn't see me, and I thought, that was weird. And I remember telling my sponsor about it, and she went, well, that's interesting, because you prayed, didn't you? And I said, yeah, but, you know, and I kind of washed it off. And hand on heart, I went through King's Cross Station again the next week, and this time he walked past me, and he was even closer, and he still didn't see me, but I could have reached out and touched him. And it was at that point I was like, okay, HP, I'm listening, because that was close. And I made amends to him. I also got to make amends to my father, which was wonderful. And we've rebuilt this relationship. I'm so blessed to have you in my life, so thank you. With step 10, and I know that this conference is all about in the now. And for me, step 10 is the why Sandy B says is all about the now. We are in the now. We have entered the world of the spirit. And when I am practicing, you know, the patience and perseverance, which are the principles of step 10, I am kept in the present, and I'm in the now, and I'm kept safe. And I don't let anything start to build up, because we're, you know, I can be like, I don't know, like a little magnet going through a junkyard if I don't practice step 10, and I start getting weighed down by it, and my, you know, my spiritual pipes get blocked. Step 11, you know, the awareness, you know, the prayer and meditation. I go out into nature as part of my step 11, and that's where I feel most connected with my higher power. So it's been beautiful to be here in the mountains and the mist. And finally, step 12, and the principle of that is service. And it is the thing that has kept me sober, right? When all else fails, work with another alcoholic will keep us safe. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing from the big book. It talks about intensive work with other alcoholics. And I have practiced that to the best of my abilities. I remember getting a 12-step call from the hospital, and I'd just come out of a really bad breakup. And, you know, it's hard in sobriety because you get all your feelings back. And, you know, rejection in sobriety, it was painful. And I basically taken to my bed. So I wasn't working. I was, like, not getting out of bed. And this call came in, and my sponsor was away. And it was the last thing I wanted to do. But I knew that it was a life ring from my higher power. And so I said to the guy at the hospital, I said, all right, no worries. Like, give me your number. I'll be down there this afternoon. And, you know, and I hadn't showered and been feeling sorry for myself. And I did, you know, I did what I used to do when I was drinking. I went and I put on, you know, the cleanest, dirtiest clothes I had. I scraped my hair back and I grabbed my big book and I went into that hospital. And that girl saved my life. I don't think I appreciate how close I was to picking up a drink over this. And I went into that hospital, and I remember looking at her, and she was in a bad way. And I remember feeling like, you know, I am her and she is me. You know, this just hadn't happened to me yet. And you know, I'm pleased to say, you know, I have the privilege of sponsoring her. And she is, a day at a time, 5 years sober. You know, so she saved me. That's the paradox of this. My sponsor would say to me, you know, I need you more than you need me. And I used to laugh at her. I think, how is that true? I'm crazy. But I know that she was right. Because I needed that girl more that day than she needed me. And so, the service treats my alcoholism, because I still have it. And there are many ways to carry the message, you know, putting out the chairs, putting out the books, manning the phone lines, ordering the literature. My mom would say, you know, even going to a meeting, you know, and getting your hair done and putting on a little bit of makeup and, like, welcoming someone, that is carrying the message. My mom sadly passed away about 10 months ago. And grief is, it's something. But I am so grateful to her for everything that she tried to, you know, carry to me. And she was such an amazing example. And so the only way that I can ever repay that, just like the only way I can ever repay my sponsor, is by trying to help someone else, by trying to carry this message, despite what my head tells me. And life, you know, life gets good, life gets busy. And so I have to, you know, I have to keep this as my primary purpose. Because for anyone that's new to sobriety or, like, new to conventions, it's like you gotta buckle up, because there are highs and there are lows. And I need to stay tethered to this program. And I need to keep saying yes to service. So thank you so much again for giving me the opportunity to come and speak. Thank you to all of you who've shared so generously in all the different meetings that we've been in. And I know that my higher power was taking care of me by putting me here tonight and by having this experience with all of you and my dad. Thank you very much again, and I wish you all the best.